Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
All right. Well, so thank you for those of us who were able to listen to the first hour. We're talking with Matthew Garrett. He is an associate professor of history at Bakersfield College in California. He is a PhD expert in, you know, Native American history, but also did his dissertation on the LDS Indian Placement Program. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the first hour, we encourage you to do so. Now we're going to kind of, you know, we talked about the history of the program. Now we're going to talk, what I'd like to do is kind of shift a little bit and talk about how this program affected lives. And I guess the two groups that I want to focus on, at least at first, are how it affected, you know, the Native Americans, how it affected their individual identities, what are the positive and the negative aspects of how this affected their culture. But I also want to dig into how it affected the families that hosted many of these Native Americans. There are lots of things said positively and negatively about those experiences. And then maybe we'll talk about the program's ultimate undoing, how it evaporated, and kind of where the church stands today with Lamanites and with Native Americans. How does that sound?
Great. And I want to talk about the decline, how the program was actually dismantled.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So I'll start with this, Matthew. I try and tell people it's a really serious thing to go to a impoverished area. You know, I guess I'll back up. One of my heroes is Malcolm X. He is a civil rights leader in the 50s and 60s, who kind of was doing the same work that Martin Luther King was doing. But what many people don't know about Malcolm X, and I strongly recommend, you know, the book by is it Haley, but also the movie that Spike Lee produced that tells the story of Malcolm X. But he was raised not as Malcolm X, but as Malcolm Little. That was what he called his slave name. And what was really important to him was that African Americans get in touch with their history, with their culture, with their heritage, because all these Africans were brought over on slave boats, sold, stripped of their identities, stripped of their language, stripped of their names, and had to assimilate into American culture. And as the civil rights movement was happening in the 50s and 60s in the United States, one of the things that the Black Power movements said was, yes, there's a lot of poverty and a lack of education among blacks. Of course, we were held as slaves for, you know, over a century or two. And we've been stripped of our culture and identity. So the reason why Malcolm X has the name Malcolm X is because he didn't know what his original name was when his ancestors were brought over. So the X sort of X'd out his slave name, which was Little, or his, you know, white name that was given to him by some master, you know, years before, generations before him. But it also represented a holding spot for whatever his actual original name was, which he didn't have anymore. But during this time, there was this whole movement of blacks going back to Africa, of figuring out about their ancestry, of learning tribal dances. And because there was this feeling like you can't be strong and move forward as a people, as a culture, unless you know where you came from. And identity is really woven into that. And so, that's what informed a lot of my empathy for Native Americans and a lot of my strong feelings about the Indian Placement Program, because I'm wondering, you know, when I try and explain people, it's a really serious thing to go to an impoverished group of people and say, hey, we're white privileged people who are educated and have a lot of money. You're super poor. we're going to tell you what your identity is. We're going to tell you who your forefathers were, and we're going to give you that identity and sense of meaning. Now, whether or not that identity has any rooting in reality is a totally different question. But I guess what I'm saying is it's a really serious thing to mess with somebody's identity, their culture, their heritage. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think one of my favorite examples is going all the way back in time to the early Mormon Indian adoptions that were happening in the 1840s and 50s. And I found this fun little side study. I was looking at some of the names they gave these kids. They adopt these Indian kids that they would pick up from a Ute trader or somebody that had captured them in a battle, and they'd make them part of their family either as an indentured servant or as a sibling or child, whatever the case is. But they had to give them names. And I thought it'd be really interesting to look at the names they gave them. And the names they gave them mostly were the same names they gave their white kids. But there was some part of the population who they would rename things that tied into the Book of Mormon, like Samuel was a really popular one. And I thought, this is interesting. These Mormons are naming these Indian kids Samuel. Now, maybe it's just because Samuel's a fairly popular name in American history in 1840s. But maybe there's some sort of hope that this is Samuel the Lamanite who's going to take the gospel back. And I think that, you know, they name them Nephi and Laman and Lemuel and all sorts of things, which have all sorts of messages. Why are they choosing those names? But there's definitely an effort to imprint an identity on these Indian children. And that continues all the way through the placement program in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. They're not renaming these children. They keep their traditional whatever name they have. Oftentimes their name's already been changed by some white bureaucrat in a boarding school, and they have a white anglicized name, or their parents perhaps chose one. But by the time they come to the Mormons, their names aren't being changed and their hair's not being cut, and it's not nearly as aggressive as the boarding school's effort to assimilate. But there's definitely an effort to connect their identity to the Book of Mormon and to a Lamanite as someone who's going to be redeemed and saved. And one of the most interesting things I came across in my readings was at BYU in the archives there was a pamphlet that was given to students, presumably, that taught them how to be a good Lamanite. And it said, you know, are you a chicken or an eagle? A good Lamanite is an eagle. And it had checklists that you could go down and you could literally assess, am I following these specific things or am I following this specific list? And for the list of an eagle was things like, do you play sports in school? Do you have good grades? Do you encourage other students to pursue their education? Do you have self-confidence? And all these sort of values that the church was trying to promote for Native Americans in the student placement program were all there. And I really like in the magazine, the pamphlet, there's two pictures along with the chicken and the eagle. And the chicken that is a downward looking Indian who's scruffy hair, and he looks like, you know, he might have some problems, social, emotional. And then there's this upward looking Indian for the eagle, and he's got a shirt and tie on and his hair is perfect. And there's this image of what a real good Lamanite's supposed to be. When you're fully redeemed, this is what you'll look like. You're not going to be whatever else. You're not going to be this traditional whatever. You're not going to be a red power activist. That's not an acceptable type of Lamanite. In the early 1970s, when red power is coming alive.
I've never even heard of red power. So that was analogous to the Black Power movement of the 60s?
Yeah, a little bit later. More closely to like brown power. But yeah, brown power and red power are kind of build off of Black Power. Okay. A little bit later. But 1970s, late 1960s, early 70s, there's a lot of Indian activism going on. They're occupying different sites. The occupation of Alcatraz is one of the most well-known in 1969, 67, and through 71. And they occupy Native Americans in organizing into groups that occupy Mount Rushmore, and they occupy the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in D.C. And so there's this activism movement going on. And at BYU, there's fear that our Native Americans who we've raised in the placement program or otherwise recruited to attend BYU that are mostly all baptized Native Americans who are, you know, learning to be good Lamanites, that they might be drawn away by this message that's not the true Lamanite message. There's a great speech, I think it's given by Elder Packer when he's visiting, and he articulates that there are voices of revolt and voices of contention, and these are not the voices of the Spirit. These hostile, militant voices, he calls them, are not the voices of the Spirit. That's not the path you should follow. That they're being told to not participate in the Indian activism movement. And at BYU, there's some debate over that. They on occasion bring out a few American Indian Movement leaders to speak. There's on at least one occasion they do. And of course, the American Indian Movement protested General Conference a couple of times. And the larger American Indian Movement, not just AIM, but the larger activism movement, even did it's called the Trail of Tears, where they marched across the country in this huge spectacle and to draw attention to the broken treaties of Native American history. And they stop in Salt Lake. And when they're in Salt Lake, they tell the church that they need to you know, they said, we've had our own vision. You guys have a vision, Mormons, that's fine. We've had a vision too. And our vision is that you're going to give us $1 million or something to help pay for the lost damages and help us get back on the right path and help our people. And the church refuses them. And there's actually a little meeting that's held. A few different church leaders are gathered in. George P. Lee is brought in to speak, to meet with them as an advocate for the church who connects to his Indian roots. Also, another guy whose name escapes me, Brown, I think his last name was. He later serves an impressive career in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but he's LDS, and he was not a placement program graduate, but he was LDS Indian. He's Pima tribe. But he also is brought in to negotiate, and so you have these Mormon Indians negotiating with these activist Red Power Indians and trying to settle what, you know, is the church's program just a whitewashing terrible thing, or is this program actually helping Indians and this is a good thing, and whose plan for how to help Indians is the best plan? And so there is a definite struggle going on in the 1970s over what's a good Lamanite, and the church has its clear model of a Lamanite is one who follows the rules and is a good, you know, participates in school and is more of a conservative model versus their more activist Red Power
model. It's kind of correlated Indians, right?
Right. Correlated Indians?
Yeah, like a correlated Indian identity, basically.
Sure. There's an effort to, you know, synchronize that you're, you know, a good Indian. An Indian and a Lamanite are one and the same, and you have to do it this proper way in order to be a redeemed Indian.
Okay. So just a little bit more about this. So I have a dear friend who's a Native American, and she talked to me about kind of multi-generational PTSD. I think that's what she called it, which is basically that if your people have been, you know, enslaved, marginalized, abused for multiple generations, stolen from, whatever the case may be, killed, that gives trauma, that sort of gives to a group of people this almost feeling of or experience of post-traumatic stress disorder, where even if you might be living in the 40s or 50s and have, you know, a reasonable chance at a decent life, the demons of what happened to your ancestors can really live on. And so we have these stereotypes on the reservation of Native Americans being, let's just say, lazy or addicted to alcohol or whatever. And so I'm thinking about how, you know, certainly the way that the Native Americans were treated by the U.S. government for centuries could account for a lot of the cultural, you know, things that we might criticize Native American culture for. And I'm sure that there's a lot of really well-intended people who saw the poverty, saw the alcoholism, saw the family problems, and really wanted to help. And so my question is, What is the positive and the negative side of coming into this group of people and saying, hey, we have an answer for you. You are children of Nephi. You are descendants of the honorable and sacred Nephi. And yes, there's a Laman and Lemuel element to it, but there's also Samuel the Lamanite and this Moroni and Mormon and this redemptive story. And here is an identity that can make you proud. Here's an identity that connects you with Christ and with God. You know, what are the positive and negative aspects of sort of trying to sell that identity to this group of people that had experienced, you know, multi-generational PTSD?
No, I think you hit really well on the positive. It's that message of hope. That's what they're looking for. They want to believe. Everyone wants to believe that they're special, at least that they're good and that they can accomplish things, that they're not, you know, failures. And so this message of hope, whether they really were failures or not, is irrelevant, that they were being told you can be better than you are. And if you just need to join this program, that's very much appealing to people who felt like it gave them confidence and courage and education and things. But on the downside, of course, there's negative consequences as well. The people that participate are not on the reservation for 9 months out of the year. They go back every summer and they might be able to retain some language and some culture, but they lose a lot of it by being mostly immersed in white culture. They lose traditional dances that are only danced at certain times of year. They never see spirituality. They're not converted as much to that spirituality because they've seen a different spirituality that's a message that hits them 9 months out of the year. Language sometimes is lost. Sometimes they retain it. Sometimes they lose it. It depends on the person. But there's a lot of cultural loss. And there's a definite feeling among graduates, people who participated in the program, there's a feeling that something was taken from them, that they lost part of their identity. And yes, they were given this prefabricated Lamanite identity that promised hope, but they would rather have what they think might be their real identity, that's, you know, their indigenous native identity. And so there's definitely some animosity and some hurt feelings, at least, people that are frustrated. And then there are those who think, no, this was wonderful for me. It just depends who you talk to.
So, you know, let's just say I was going to be kind of a racist, insensitive kind of person and say, what's the big deal about losing these dances? Like, I'm sure 200 years ago there was a hoedown and a bunch of white people dancing in a barn, and we don't do those dances anymore, and, you know, we're doing okay. And, yeah, you know, I'm sure that we spoke differently 400 or 500 years ago than we speak now, but you know, let's just all converge on a language, and English is a powerful language that's spoken all over the world. You know, so, and yeah, you know, maybe there were medicine men and these spiritual sort of Native American practices, but, you know, we've got the restored gospel and we've got a superior form of spirituality. So, like, what's the big deal about losing your language? What's the big deal about losing your culture, your dances, your authentic identity, your outdated, backwards form of spirituality when you've inherited, you sort of upgraded in all those areas? Now, again, that's extremely
sure
offensive, but I think there's probably a lot of listeners who haven't given this much thought and might be entertaining some of those thoughts.
No, you're right. There's an interview with NPR did a special on the placement program maybe 3 or 5 years ago or something. And in that, they included an interview with Claire Bishop, the administrator I mentioned to earlier. And he made a comment very similar to that. He said, you know, what's wrong with losing that old culture of alcoholism and poverty? This is something much better that we're providing. And on some level, there is better social financial possibility to move up financially. But, you know, culture and identity is something that's very intimate and personal, and I don't know that anyone has the authority to come into someone else's life and tell them your identity is invalid and you must have this one. And you know, a lot of these people, they participate and they adopt this new identity, and they look back on it because, you know, it was something that was positive because they believe in it. But those who did not adopt it, those who rejected it especially, or later in their lives rejected it, they have hurt feelings. And I don't have an answer for why they should have hurt feelings. I mean, I think everyone has the right to their own practices and culture and identity, and I don't think anyone should be, you know, imposing their identity on someone else. But then what do you do with the people who adopt it and say, yeah, this is my identity, I like it? Are they sellouts? You know, are the Mormon Indians who had adopted the Lamanite identity and said, yeah, this is part of me, this is who I am, are they, what do you do with them? That's the more difficult question, I think. I think it's very easy to say, look, there's people who are upset. They're definitely upset. They lost their culture, identity, they lost parts of their culture, and that's frustrating. But the more difficult group to me is, what do you do with those who adopted this artificial, created thing, and do you call them sellouts? Are they, you know, coconuts and apples is the derogatory term sometimes given to Indians who are more progressive? And, you know, I mean, that's the complicated part, is how do you justify whose identity is authentic? And I think the best route is to just let everybody decide for themselves what their identity is, because I don't really have any authority to tell you what you have to be.
And the only thing I'll just add, answering kind of my own question, is you know, you could argue that American U.S. culture has a history of doing some good things, but also maybe has a history of violence and of oppression and of elitism and imperialism that, you know, has brought a pretty high standard of living for those who have the privilege of benefiting from it. But there's a lot of pain and sadness and destruction and you know, negative residue that's come about by the people who sort of were on the wrong side of privilege and affluence, you know, from where we've taken our resources. You know, we've built our affluence on the backs of people and resources that we were used to our advantage and not necessarily to the advantage of those, you know, from whom we've appropriated these right. goods. And so you could argue not only have we done a lot of harm in the, but also that there are other cultures and ways of life that really could teach us something. Love of the land, for example, a different form of spirituality that's more inclusive, maybe communal values that are very special in their own right, that aren't reflecting the individuality, sort of the rugged individuality of American capitalism. And, you know, maybe there's just a lot we could learn from Native American culture and language and religious and spiritual practice and even psychology and community. Is that fair to say?
Sure. I think, you know, hegemonic control of, you know, allows you to extract efficiently and you can extract resources but it's not the most inclusive approach and there's a lot to be lost if we just bulldoze on everything and impose this particular, you know, Europe, this Utah-centered culture on everybody, then it's not particularly likely to protect and encourage alternative thought and different ideas. And
yeah. And just like if you mow down all the forests in Brazil, you lose a lot of biodiversity and species that are helpful not only just because they're beautiful, but also because they provide all sorts of benefits to our society, from pharmaceuticals to other types of things. You know, there's just some, clearly we've evolved biologically where diversity is a huge and important element of our success as a planet, as a species, whatever you want to call it. So cultural diversity, probably logic would dictate, can serve a same benefit. And whenever we mow down an entire culture, there's a huge loss to the cultural diversity that we all could benefit from. Is that fair to say?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So let's talk a bit about what, and we're kind of jumping around a bit, but that's, you know, that's why I'm doing this and I think it's okay. Let's talk about what the program was specifically like. So just real quick, from you're at the reservation and you're a 12-year-old boy, all the way through you getting placed with the family to then what the family experience was like.
Right. So as a child, you know, 12-year-old boy or whatever, you're on the reservation attending boarding school and you might have some missionaries drop by and maybe they're teaching a class at the boarding school or maybe a friend of a friend referred them to come by your home. And so they introduced the program. They would recruit you. You'd get interested and excited about all the promises that were made about it's like going off to camp, but really nice camp.
Real quick, and these boarding schools were run by who?
The Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Okay, so there's this federal bureau in the mid-1900s, starting with the late 1800s, that are running these boarding schools on the reservation.
Yes.
Because the Native Americans didn't want to run their own schools?
Sometimes they're run by churches or other groups as well, but the BIA was the most dominant.
And why weren't the Natives running their own schools just like we do here in Logan, Utah?
Well, there was a general distrust and resistance to schools altogether in the 1800s and white people trying to constantly encroach on their lands and, you know, just another. There was always some who were the ones who went to school and did that, but there was general resistance. And so there was just a history, the momentum of different religious groups and the federal government trying to assimilate, would build schools and try to.
Okay. So they're in these boarding schools and then they somehow get in contact with the missionaries.
So the missionaries would encounter the Indian youth in some fashion and would teach them some lessons about the gospel and pitch the program to him and or her. And then they'd tell the parents about it, and then they would sign them up. And Earlier in the program, it was all done by missionaries. Later, by the 1970s, it was done by caseworkers, and the missionaries would just refer the person to the caseworkers, but the missionaries often played a role in trying to prep them and get them all hyped up and excited for it and tell them about the program, and then maybe it was more of a formality to have the caseworker come. But at any rate, they would get recruited. They would go at the beginning of the fall school year, they would go meet at a local spot, usually a grocery store or a retail place or a chapel or some sort of strip mall. They would gather there, and there'd be some buses that would gather and come by and pick up all the kids. They in the early years of the program, before it was official, it was all done individually. People just found their own rides. But by 1950s and later, there's a bus that would pick them up, and they'd have a bus or two that would pick up the kids, and the kids would say goodbye to mom and dad, and they'd roll down their windows as the bus drove away, waving off, and some of the other younger kids who didn't go on placement would chase behind, screaming, and it was, adios, have fun. And it was an exciting thing. And then they'd ride the bus for hours through the afternoon and evening, and they'd play card games and talk and tell stories. I'm sure some of the more experienced kids would tell what it was like, and some of the newer kids were probably fairly afraid and scared and worried. And the bus drove and drove and drove until morning time.
Basically, so from Arizona to Utah, is that the most common route?
Yeah. Yes. Early in the program, they were all going through Richfield. Richfield, because that's where it started, just continued to be the hub. And so they would bus them there. But later in the years, by the 1970s and 80s, they're busing them to different hubs all over the place, and not just from the Navajo Reservation, but from all sorts of Indian reservations. Eventually, the program expands into Canada, and it's they're all over the place. But early on, and the most common would have been going out of the Navajo Reservation, and you take by the bus to Richfield, Utah. You arrive at 6 in the morning, the bus unloads, all the kids step off, and a bunch of volunteer Mormons are there unloading the bottom side of the bus, the carriage, pulling out the suitcase or two for each kid, and the kids would be marched into, lined up and walked into the chapel or into the building, and there'd be someone there passing out name tags that put a tag on their name, and they'd go into a large intercultural hall where they'd play games and kind of run around while they're getting everything set up. Oh, I'm sorry, before the cultural hall games, they'd go into the cultural hall and there'd be breakfast set up. Breakfast would be provided by the local relief society. They'd have, cereals and pancake or whatever else. But they'd do that. In the early years of the program, there was a lot of kids who were dirty and malnourished and all sorts of disease and other things. And so early on, Miles Jensen's wife felt the need to bathe them and clean them and provide this whole medical experience, which faded out by the end of the program because kids were coming from homes that had a little more wealth. But in the 1950s and 60s, the kids would go and do a medical exam. They'd have volunteer doctors from the local wards and nurses and whoever else, and they'd set up sheets to block off rooms, and they'd go in and get a physical. They'd get their hair washed, and they'd get sort of cleaned up a little bit to look like nice, ready-to-go middle-class family kids. And then they would be sent back to the cultural hall for games and activities. Meanwhile, the foster parents would go through some sort of orientation meeting in the chapel or someplace where they told them, okay, you're going to see these Indian kids. They're different than your kids. They have different cultures. Do your best. This is the Lord's program. Stick with it. And so they then would pair them up into small rooms around the building. They'd pair up the child and the foster parents, and they would meet each other with the caseworker introducing them, and then they'd be sent on their way to go live with that family for the next 9 months.
Now, was this part of the foster program of the state or the federal government? Was it like integrated with government support?
Totally independent. Nope, totally an independent program, which gets them into some trouble in the 1970s because some of the folks that were opposed to the program, growing with the Red Power and activism movement in the 70s, growing opposition got them into trouble over that, and they had to go to court. And actually, well, not go to court, but go to Congress. There's some testimony given at Congress that the placement program was being examined as being, this assimilative program that's stealing children. And in 1978, when Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act, was designed to protect Indian children from being extracted illegally for adoption or whatever else. And there's lots of county caseworkers who are taking Indian kids because they live in squalor, and they say, well, that's not a good home for you. And they'd put them in a white middle-class family. And so that sort of policy was just ripping all these Indian kids out of the reservations at the same time as the placement programs running independently. One estimate was that something like 30% of children raised in the 1970s, Indian children, were being raised in white homes, which is outrageous. So because of that, you have this law passed. And along with that law, there was investigation into the placement program. And there was some debate over whether or not the placement program was following federal regulations. But ultimately, it came down to the placement program operating under the licensure of the Relief Society, which had a license to for the social services, had a license. So it was legally okay, but a lot of folks felt very uncomfortable about the legal status of the program.
Okay, so in terms of placement of Native Americans, I think you mentioned this at the very beginning, the Indian placement program was only a small, you know, let's say 30% of the total placements. The federal or state governments were doing this at even a larger scale.
Yes, but the federal government placement was for adults, so it's significantly different. They would go out and they had these flyers they'd give out to adults, and they'd say, "Why don't you come move to the city, and we'll help get you set up with a job, and we'll put you in an apartment that we can find for you, and we'll get you all set up, and you know, we'll help you out for a couple months, and then you'll be on your own, and you can do this." And they'd show them these white picket fence homes and things that they were never going to live in, and then they'd eventually get them on buses on Greyhound, give them a one-way ticket, and move them out to Chicago or someplace across the country. And that was a totally separate federal program for adults. Gradually, it included family units, but it was an adults program. The Mormon placement program is totally just on children. So it's very different, but it's kind of the same theme, you know, relocation and urbanization of Indians.
But there's still the foster programs that the states would have been operating, right?
Right. Every state's running its own foster program, and there's increasingly they're taking kids off of reservations. And so that's what's growing, gaining. There's opposition to that in the 1970s, and that's why you get the Double for Act.
And so those things are happening parallel to each other, the state foster programs with the Indian placement program.
Yeah, the 1970s activism created this awareness of how bad it's getting for Indian kids being pulled off reservations, and then there's this huge outcry against white people removing Indian kids, which of course spills over to the placement program, which wasn't its intended target initially, but it's one of these groups that's taking kids off the reservation.
Right, right.
But the significant difference is the county takes a kid because they say you're an improper parent and we're taking that child. Placement says, hey, you want your kid to join? It's totally voluntary. And so but then again, some people joined because they were financially strapped and they thought, I can't take care of my kid and send him to boarding school or send him to placement or send him someplace. And so, you know, and oftentimes the kids would hear about how fun this is. And so they'd, come on, mom, let me go. So, but it's a little bit different because it's not a social services taking kids away, you know, without voluntary. It's totally voluntary to participate in placement.
And the biological families never received in the Indian placement program any financial, you know, compensation.
Right. There's no money trend. No, there's no biological parents don't get paid. Foster parents don't get paid, which is a point of concern for some foster parents. They felt like we're taking this kid and, you know, there's not any help. Like, what if he needs medical something? He has to get, you know, his teeth done or something. That's going to be expensive. And the church did its best to try to insulate parents by by taking care of them at the reception center at Richfield or wherever else. They'd take care of them. And if they needed more in-depth help, they would send them off to in Salt Lake City, the children's hospital that the church had. They would take care of them there. So there was all sorts of efforts to try to resolve any significant financial strain. But for the most part, entirely, there was no financial. It was all voluntary participation on both ends.
Okay, so how did they match up family to child? Was it like a lottery? How did it happen?
The caseworkers would do their best to try to figure out what they thought was appropriate. There's a couple interviews where they'd say, they'd ask, you know, do you like horses? Well, okay, this family has a ranch, so we'll put you with this you know, cowboy Mormon over here that's got horses. Or you're the oldest child in the family. Well, we'll put you in a family where you're the oldest child or the youngest child. They'll put you in a family where you're the youngest child, so you can sort of maintain some of those. If you're in a family of you're a young woman, they'll put you in a family with girls, obviously, not with boys, or maybe if it's boys and girls, but not just a boy. So they try to pair them up as best they could based on interest, based on place and family, based on whatever else they thought was appropriate. But it was up to the discretion of the caseworkers. Caseworkers were arbitrarily assigned. You know, you have all the kids in this area, and you might have a huge caseload of like 70, 80, 100 kids sometimes, which is gigantic. Modern day caseworkers have, I don't know, what, 20 kids or something? So it's a massive caseload, but they would do their best to pitch them, put them in places and families they thought would be a good fit. And it often didn't work. Oftentimes kids didn't fit in. They didn't like it. The foster families didn't work with them. There was problems. And so they'd get moved to a different family, sometimes mid-year, sometimes the next year. A lot of foster families got burned out after just 1 year and quit. And so they'd have to find new foster families frequently.
And was this a calling for the caseworkers?
No, it was a job.
So the church did pay the caseworkers.
Yes. There's a great quote from Kimball where they're talking about expanding the program in the early, early years. They've got Miles Jensen. They've got Buchanan. And they're thinking, well, now we need some more caseworkers. This is really rolling. Who do we hire and how much do we pay them? And in the Indian committee, they're discussing this. And so we have the notes. And Kimball says, well, this is kind of a calling sort of thing. This is, I mean, it's a job. We got to pay them enough to survive, but they should be doing this out of service to God, and so we don't need to pay them the going rate. And so there's a conscious decision to pay church employees in the social system, and at least in this particular program, less than the going rate, because they should be doing it not out of financial motivation, but out of love for the program and the kids and whatever else, which is something I think is still lingering in the church. You know, tends to pay a little bit lower than the going rate in most areas.
Interesting. And was there ever this dynamic of like a parent saying, I want that one. He's really cute or she's really darling. And where almost the kids felt like they were slaves, you know, being sold to the highest bidder kind of thing.
I've not seen anything like that. I haven't asked that question, so it's possible, but I've not seen anything that would suggest to me that that's the case. Okay. It seems to me that they would just, they go into a room and there's the foster parents were sitting there, and then they go get the kid and they bring the kid into the room and here's your child. And, you know, they'd, hi, you know, my name's so-and-so. Let's try to work it out. And they'd drive home. Maybe I'd stop for ice cream on the way or something to try to, you know, ease the transition. But they'd go back to their respective foster homes and be utterly surprised. It was their first time in placement. They'd be totally surprised by this weird place they're in. You know, there's electricity and running water and all these strange appliances. In George P. Lee's his biography, he writes about how wondrous it was that there was, you know, electrical everything. There was television. It was like Disneyland, he says. The kitchen was just fantastic. And there's other interviews as well. From people talking about how the kids would play with the light switches because they were just amazed at lights going on and off, or the phone would ring and they'd answer it and they didn't know how to answer. They'd just pick it up and stare at it. And there was a fascination with technology. They'd have to get used to white Mormon Utah culture's expectations of cleanliness, that they're going to take baths and showers all the time. That wasn't something they would have done on the reservation very often. Most places of the reservation didn't have running water, so water was something to be valued and scarce. You're not going to waste it on a bath every day. So there's some different cultural things. They were amazed by the food. Student interviews of foreign students, former students, often talk about how much food these white people had. These white people had so much food and salads and whatever else. And over time, they got used to it, and that became normal to them. There's a great comment from one biological mother. She said when her child came back from placement, she didn't want her child to go back. And when asked why, she said, well, because now she wants salad all the time, and I can't provide that, and I can't keep up with these expectations that she's getting from living with these white people because they have so much affluence. So there was a definite change, and, you know, and I think that probably impacts the students' view of I can only assume that a lot of the students started to view their own reservation home in deficiencies, you know, that this place doesn't have this and this place doesn't have that. But at the same time, they also saw problems with their foster homes. They thought, oh my gosh, I have my own room, but it's so small and I'm trapped in this suburban city and everybody's watching, and wherever I go, people know who I am, and it's crowded. On the Navajo reservation, you're spread out. You have like one home for every few miles. You have lots of space to run around, do what you want, and you have autonomy. Not here in this culture. There's clocks and times, and you have to be at places all the time, and people always want to know where you're going and who you're going with, and they felt like they were under watch all the time. So, you know, different attitudes about living with white folks.
Right.
So then as they're living there for the school year, they went to school, they participated in activities, they were encouraged to participate in clubs and sports and anything else. They get involved in scouting. Scouting was really popular on the Navajo Reservation starting in the 40s and 50s, totally independent of Mormons. And it started to get really popular among the placement students, and they were excited to have their first Eagle Scout, I think in 1967. But they participate in all sorts of extracurricular. Lots of the interviews I've read tons of interviews, and they almost all talk about how well they were received by their schoolmates. They didn't feel like they were being treated as bad or viewed negatively. Some of them did comment about how they were a novelty, how they felt like the kids thought it was so special to have a real cowboy Indian. We got an Indian now, you know? And so that was definitely a little bit weird.
Kind of like a circus sideshow,
yeah,
or something.
Right. They're the show. It's pretty cool. But, you know, at the same time, there wasn't a negative thing like, oh, you dirty Indians. There wasn't that negative racism that was really hostile. They didn't experience very. I don't think I've read that anywhere. Hardly that anyone was filling out. So they did school. They participated there. Some of them did quite well. Some of them did quite poorly. Foster families often experience strain. There's a few different studies the church organized to survey foster parents and foster kids and church leaders and tribal leaders. And in those surveys, it shows that the Wasatch Opinion Report of 1979 says that a lot of the foster parents, they expressed a little bit of difficulty, that it was tough, but it was worth it, kind of an attitude. But the foster siblings, the white Mormon kids that were siblings, most of them were very dissatisfied with the program. They did not like it. They weren't happy with it. They thought that their parents were being taken from them, that they didn't like sharing their parents. They didn't get along with the kids. There was a fairly negative response from the foster siblings. But not so much from the parents. The parents and the tribal leaders and everybody else had a pretty positive attitude about the program.
Okay, so tribal leaders liked it.
White
parents liked it.
Yeah, well, mostly. Some of them, you know, difficult, but worth it because they felt like they were fulfilling some spiritual, you know, they were doing their duty.
So and the students like generally it. Liked it.
Divided. There's no comprehensive. I figure if there's 50,000 students, I'm going to have to talk to 50,000 to have a very good opinion, because I've just read such widely varying, and it depends who you talk to. You talk to someone who's raised in Phoenix, and they've kind of adopted, in a lot of ways, white culture. They have a regular professional job, and they're more inclined to say it was worth it. You know, it was tough, but it was worth it. And then you talk to someone on the reservation, and they're like, those guys tried to whitewash me, you know. And so it's hard to really get a guess for what the average attitude was, but it's clear to me that there's different opinions about it. Some people hated it. Some people loved it. Lots of people are in the middle, kind of feeling like, well, I'm not sure it was. So
okay.
Overall,
so
attitude,
mixed. Mixed for the students, overall favorable for the tribal leaders and the parents, but overall negative for the siblings, if you had to generalize. Is that right?
Yeah, if I had to, that's right.
Okay.
So, and then during the school year, they participated in regular activities. There was every month or two, there'd be some sort of activity managed by their caseworker. So the caseworkers got a few different districts, and all those districts in total make up his caseload or her caseload. And so each district would have its own activities that might be something like a roller skate party or a fireside or an ice cream party or a dance or a basketball tournament. And they would do something every month or two. And then eventually those sort of evolved into to having a culminating conference at the end, which then became the district conferences that led to the regional conferences, so the churchwide conferences, and it became this massive program by the 70s. But
so what
they
participated
about in that too?
What about dating? Like, you know, the white girl and the dark, you know, Native American, or vice versa. The
scary.
How did the Mormon culture handle interracial dating?
Yeah. Well, you're familiar, of course, with there's some quotes from the 50s era. I think Kimball's one of them that said things to the effect of interracial dating and marriage isn't a good idea, and that there's a cultural gap that is a problem. And you can look at it as racist or culturalist or whatever, but there was generally discouragement. And in the case of the placement program, that was very much the case. In fact, the socials started, those socials they participated in didn't exist at the very beginning, but they emerged because Kimball said, we need some place for these Indian kids to meet other Indian kids, because some of the white people are getting a little uncomfortable and we don't want them dating white girls. Let's provide a forum where they can meet other Indians who are experiencing the same thing. But it's very much also fueled by this worry that they're going to date white girls. And so we need to provide this alternative activity, which eventually that's what these conferences
do. Was there also a fear about dating white boys?
I've only seen a few passages where they actually speak directly about it. I just sort of infer it from things I've read. And in the couple passages I've read, I don't think they delineate gender at all, but I think there's a general worry about it. I don't know. Throughout history, you know, whether we're talking about this or Americans or Spaniard colonization of America or something, there tends to be that our patriarchal European background makes it a little bit more okay for a European guy to redeem or save or marry or whatever, someone who's not white, but vice versa is a problem. You know, so
the concern
I
was for the girls, the white girls marrying Native boys.
Yeah, but I don't know. I can't.
Possibly.
I don't see, you know, that's what I see generally outside this experience, particular example, but, you know, it was quite possible that was the case here too. I don't know.
Okay. And so they tried to create, was there a point where that shifted where, like, let's say in the 70s and 80s, it became totally fine for for whites to white Mormons to date Native Americans?
I'm not aware of any. I don't see much talk about it later. I don't know if the lack of discussion means that it changed, or because they're no longer discouraging it, or if that means that it's just not being discussed. Or
certainly, it did happen some, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. There's some of the people I've interviewed for this. You know, I've interviewed guys that were a missionary on the Southwest Indian Mission who married a Native American girl that they fell in love with, and you know, there's definitely interracial marriage, but initially, early on, it was kind of discouraged, but it was less super, and less discouraged.
Was it super rare, or just kind of, you know?
I don't have any numbers
okay,
on.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. That's fine. Okay, so what were some of the family dynamics that were good and bad for the students and for the families that were typical? So was it like, oh, he became my best older brother, and I had a new older brother, and it was amazing, and he taught me all these cool things? Or was it like, oh, he was drinking and smoking and sleeping around or abusing our children? Like, what, you know, what were the positive and negative experiences that were most typical?
I think that as I've spoken to former foster parents, they've often said the positive things, but I don't know what. You know, that's because they're telling a story they know is going to be published, and they don't want to talk about the bad things, I suspect.
So what were the positive things?
You know, that so-and-so, little Tommy, was such a good kid. He went to school, and he played in sports, and he was a good member of the family, and he served in his ward and whatever calling, and, you know, he's the teacher's quorum president or something. You know, it surely happened. And then there's also incidents that they get reported to the Indian Committee, and so we have minutes of problems where there's people not following the rules so well, not particularly about interfamily relationships, but just generally about not following the rules. One of my favorite letters is from a missionary serving in the Southwest Indian Mission, and he's just shocked and horrified by what's going on with these placement students on the summer. That during the school year, they seem like they're good Mormon kids, and then on the summer, they're out here drinking and having sex and doing whatever, and he's just horrified and writing letters back. And there's another letter that somebody wrote to a foster parent wrote to President Lee complaining about how these kids, you know, weren't following the rules, and they think they're Catholic, and there's definitely problems. But overall, what was the general trend? I don't know. It seems like they followed the rules or they quit. They knew if they didn't follow the rules, they would get kicked out of the program.
Right.
And so if you wanted to stay there, you follow the rules during those 9 months. During the summertime, it's vacation. There was an expectation that during the summer you'd go to church and follow the rules, but there was no one really watching. And so you could, you know, relapse or whatever, go back to your whatever you wanted to do. But during the school year, it seemed like they generally followed the expectations that were laid out in the handbook they had to follow.
Okay, so overall, there was a feeling of general compliance and with some exceptions of bad experiences, and then a lot of just normal good experiences, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Now there's a stereotype that I've often heard recounted of sexual abuse happening, where maybe even there was sexual abuse in the native cultures, and then, you know, daughters or young boys being abused by the native student. Is that overblown? Is that fiction? Is that just occasionally it's happened, but super rare?
I've asked about it a couple times to some of the administrators and caseworkers I've interviewed, and nobody has any recollection of this happening. I'm sure it must have happened because we're human beings and there's people who take advantage of situations, and I'm sure it happened somewhere here and there, as it happens in any home in America. It could happen in any home. But
in white culture
general
too,
practice,
right?
I don't think that's right. I mean, it happens. It happened in Native American boarding schools. It happens in white foster families that have foster kids. It happens in black families. It happens everywhere. So yeah. I'm sure it probably happened, but not in a noteworthy, nothing significant. The only place I found any sort of documentation was there was an article written in the 70s where the guy who wrote the article made that accusation, but he had no evidence, and all of his other accusations I know were wrong. So I'm inclined to think he fabricated it, but there's really no – I'm sure it happened, you know, just like it does in any other family in America, but not particularly noteworthy. No.
So this is significant to me because this is something I've heard a lot. And if you're one of the most well-read people on this whole program and you're saying it wasn't a prevailing narrative, that means there's kind of a disparity between what some people think about the program and what the average experience was.
Sure. There's a lot of interesting wrong. I mean, there's some people I've read that one article I read talked about how the kids were in, you know, basically slave servants put to work on the farms. And, you know, that's not true at all. I'm sure that there were some kids placed in a rural farm area and that they had chores just like any other kid would have. But so there's, I think there's some misunderstandings. Sure.
Okay.
And also child abuse tends to be a pretty common theme in any sort of child placement story. You know, if we talk about foster kids anywhere, you're going to see that. Or you talk about boarding schools, you're going to see that. So I'm sure people are sort of looking for it also.
Got it. Okay. But, well, that's good. That's actually an important sort of stereotype to dispel then. Not that it didn't happen, but that it wasn't rife and prevalent everywhere based on your experience.
Right.
Okay. So maybe just talk briefly about kind of what the average success story was for the student and what the average failure story was for the student so that we can just get a sense for kind of the best product, quote, unquote, that this program released. And then let's say the worst, quote, product.
In 1982, the presiding bishopric had a draft report created and then published it or circulated it in 84 in the church. But it assessed whether these kids were successful or not. And it was trying to evaluate whether this program was working. And so it gives us a few different categories that they were looking for in the presiding bishopric for what means success. They broke it into LDS activity, into social functionality, and into economic success. And so for LDS activity, they looked at whether or not they took surveys and said, you know, do you believe in Jesus Christ? Do you pray before a meal? Do you drink coffee? Do you use the Bible? Or do you use tobacco? And so they'd ask these sorts of questions.
And this was after they're done with the program? A longitudinal study kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they'd ask to see how did it work, you know, and they cross-referenced that with all sorts of things like how many years were you in and where were you at and where are you from. But generally speaking, that gives you an idea what they're looking for in spirituality. They want to know do you have a temple marriage? That was one of the questions. So those who served in the program were more likely to believe in Jesus, more likely to pray before a meal, less likely to drink coffee, more likely to attend Relief Society meetings. No difference in whether or not they believed in the Bible or used tobacco. So I don't know. Those are some sort of facts, some, you know, key things they're looking for in social adaptability.
What about just likelihood to remain a member of the church?
I think they're all members because they're baptized, so they stay members. They're not likely to go through the effort. I mean, very few people go through the effort to get excommunicated or to remove their record. So, you know, the church tends to view everyone as a member, whether they want to be a member or not.
Did we see like a swelling of wards on the reservations where the church starts thriving in the reservations?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The reservations are building more and more wards. They're going to be managed by white people who are called as bishop from neighboring towns, but eventually they'll transfer most of the leadership callings except for bishop over to those wards, and more wards, and eventually a stake. I think in 1994, they create the first Native American stake, the Chinle stake on the Navajo Reservation. So yeah, there's definite growth of membership, but they have horrible problems with inactivity and, you know, there's high rates of inactivity.
Okay. Okay, social. You're going to social next?
Social. The kids who participated in the program were less likely to vote in tribal elections, which might suggest that they're thinking outside the reservation more. Here's an interesting one. If they've been in the program for 8 years or more, they're more likely to be arrested.
Wow. What's that about?
I don't know. But the study ultimately concluded that if you were in the program for 0 to 4 years, you had minimal success. And if you were in the program for more than 8 years, it started to become bad, like you were overly exposed or something. And so the magic window was 4 to 8 years is how long you should be in the program. And starting with this report in 84, the church starts to reduce enrollment so that you can only join in high school, so that, you know, junior high and high school, and then just high school, so we can reduce that window so we don't have people in that category anymore. They noticed that they were increasingly happy for the first 72 months of their experience, and then after that they started to become less happy. So for the first few years they were more happy, but then after that happiness declined. They had more marital quarrels if they participated in the program.
Interesting.
the more years they had on placement, the interesting. I know. It's, so you wonder, there's elements of the traditional culture that were perhaps inclined to be less marital quarrels that we've removed in European culture. Now they're more inclined to fight with their spouse. The more they're on placement, the less likely they were to support Indian assimilation, that they thought Indians, the longer you're in placement, the less you liked assimilation, is interesting, because you would think the longer they're in placement, the more they would like assimilation, but that's not the case. They thought, well, now I value my culture even more because I've been in placement, which actually goes back to some of the surveys they took where kids said, by serving on being in placement, I value my culture more. I think like 65% of them said that.
Wow, so that's fascinating.
Some of them opposed that idea, but slightly more than half said, I value my culture more. But there's still a huge chunk that said, no, I don't. I value it less thanks to these guys whitewashing me. So there's some, and then economic, they're more likely to have a bank account. They're not more likely to hold a job any longer. They're less likely to be dependent on their parents. They have a higher annual income if they served in the program, especially for more than 4 years, and they're more likely to go to college. Though there was another report at BYU where they were assessing some of these kids and whether or not the program was a success. And at BYU, they said it's mixed. You don't really can't tell. The kids who went on placement, the ones who didn't because some went to boarding schools and then went to BYU, can't really tell. Some of the best students are from both groups. Some of the worst students are from both groups. So they might have gone to college more likely, but their success at college wasn't any better. It was pretty much the same as kids who didn't go on placement.
Wow. So mixed results then.
Yeah. So, what's a successful student is ideally someone who doesn't smoke tobacco or drink coffee and, goes to church and has a good job and a bank account. And someone who doesn't do those things is the real example of people that aren't, they reject the program. They said, I don't buy into this. This is assimilation or something. But,
and of course the things we're measuring in those studies are things rooted in Western values, right?
Right. Absolutely. Sure. But it gives you an idea of the people asking the questions, these white Mormon sociologists or whoever they're sending are what they think is what Mormons think is success and whether or not the Indians are achieving it.
Right. All right. So let's talk now about the decline. How did this all unravel?
Well, that presiding bishopric report was one of the elements that had to do with declining of the church or declining of the program. By the 1970s, with the Indian activism really changing opinions and people kind of concerned about these kids getting whitewashed, and that sort of spilled over to the church. The church does a really good job of holding a stoic face and saying, we will not be impacted by these activists and we don't accept this and we don't acknowledge this. But privately, the brethren start to debate this, and you don't hear much about it because the church doesn't like to show a divided front. But you can see little excerpts here and there in different interviews that suggest that there was some division. That people were starting to gain. There's some opposition to the church, to the program within the brethren.
Which interviews show this?
Well, there's, for example, if you go to Victor Brown's interview that's located in the church archives, he was the presiding bishop. He talks about how the presiding bishopric and the apostles were constantly fighting and all the committee meetings, they don't get along and how they're really dysfunctional. Of course, Victor Brown was an airline corporate guy, big company that he was in charge of. He was vice president or something. And so he understands how corporate America runs, and he says, this is not effective. You can't run an organization like this. And there's infighting. And it really goes back to the transfer of power from Kimball to all of these committees that are going to start running the program, which one of your Facebook comments was to ask, someone had said, I heard that the program was taken away from Kimball or something to that effect. And that's true. In 1956, I want to say, when we created social services or unified social services, at that point, Kimball was on trip. He was in Europe on a mission in Britain, I think, for 2 weeks. And while he was gone, the apostles or someone decided up in church hierarchy that they were going to reorganize the placement program as part of this new social services program, which basically took it out from Kimball's oversight and the Indian Committee's oversight and put it in the social services, which answers to the Relief Society, which answers to the presiding bishopric, which answers to the prophet. And so Kimball got sidestepped while he was out of the country.
So that I heard very similar things happening with the blacks in the priesthood, that when Harold B. Lee was out of town, David O. McKay or whoever, Hugh B. Brown, got the brethren to vote to give blacks the priesthood in like the late 60s. So that's a second instance where people are doing things while others are out of town. That feels very passive aggressive.
Yeah. Well, if you can't get something done, you know, I suppose that's one way. But so they moved it over to this. It's the bureaucratization of the placement program. From that point on, it gets shuffled around within social services, and different people are in charge. And Kimball has to watch. He can still throw his apostolic power around and tell people you should participate and speak about it at conference, but he no longer has direct control. And it answers to these committees, and particularly to what's the committee? The welfare committee. There's an executive and a not executive welfare committee. I get them confused. But the welfare committee in Salt Lake is going to have oversight, and the members of that committee include an apostle or two, a 70 or two, the presiding bishop or bishopric member, and a few other folks here and there, members, the directors of the different programs and social services. But over time, the program becomes one of several different social programs. The church ran a different foster care program for troubled kids or whatever, and the church ran an adoption program, and the church has all these different social services that it's running. And placement just becomes one of those programs. And so at the local level, there's some caseworker who may not know anything about Indians or care about Indians who's assigned to the placement program in that local town. And that's not nearly as committed as in the early years where you had some return missionary that Kimball had handpicked who was going to be an advocate. And all the way up the chain of command, there's really nobody there as you have different 70 members of the 70 that get put in as in charge of watching the program and the presiding bishopric. And so different people have different opinions, and we don't really know all that happens in these committee meetings because people don't generally talk about it. But we do know from President Kimball's the biography that his son wrote. There's the passage about them making this decision while Kimball's out of the country that he took out of Kimball's notes. And then we also have another passage from someone else about how Elder Packer was on this committee, and Elder Packer was a little bit opposed. He felt like Indians were investing a lot of energy on Native Americans. And what are we getting out of it? Look at Latin America. You know, look at the Polynesian Islands. Look at Africa and the rest of the world. There's all these people. One of Elder Packer's favorite stories that he's told in his biography, he's told it in General Conference several times, is the story of how he was down in, I think, Chile or somewhere in Latin America, and there's a child that comes and he has a big raggedy shirt on, and this child is so poor, and his heart just melts for this child, and he thinks, what are we doing? We need to be helping this kid. And so I think that Elder Packer had an increasingly international view, and he's seeing all these people that the church should be helping, and he's thinking, why are we spending so much energy on these Indians who, I mean, it's not working that great. Look at the presiding bishopric report. It's kind of working, kind of not, and it's mixed results, and we should help these people who really, you know, can really benefit. And so Packer, who was once the advocate for the Native Americans, the people thought he was, he's the guy that wrote the Indian Seminary Program. A lot of people thought he would follow Kimball as the new Indian apostle. He actually doesn't want to. There's a great quote from, George P. Lee says that Elder Packer said, so you take it as it is, but it's also been cited to Elder Packer in other places. Elder Packer said something to the effect of, I do not want or wish to be known as an apostle to the Lamanites, as President Kimball was. I am not an apostle to the Indians, but to the whole church. And I don't think that there's anything malicious about that comment, but it does show that his mindset is broader, and he's thinking, why are we spending so much energy on these guys? And so we know that that Packer chaired this welfare committee during the time of the program getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And we know that the administrators who oversaw the program talk about how they're confused. They're getting mixed directives. One time it's grow the program. One time it's reduce the program. We know that Victor Brown says that it's craziness, that it just depends who's there and who's in charge. It fluctuates. But ultimately, the motion comes that we need to reduce the program and we need to shrink it down, using the presiding bishopric as a justification that we need to get it down to just 4 years or so, 4 to 5, 6 years, not more than that.
Around what year is this shrinkage starting to happen?
Late 70s, early 80s.
And Kimball died when?
When did he die? Right around then.
Okay, so Kimball dies and then the brethren feel free to start dismantling,
right,
basically.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
And even in his last few years while he's alive, you know, he's missing General Conference, his health is not good, and that's when it starts to happen. It's just in his last couple years. But he, even as the prophet at that point, he has very little sway because the committees are running everything, according to Victor Brown.
Right.
So he, even though he's a prophet, he can't protect his baby program. It's, you know, he's got broader issues he's supposed to be looking after, and let the committees run that. So at the same time that the program is just being cut, all the other Indian programs are being cut as well. The Indian program at BYU being cut up, the Indian Seminary dissolved, the Southwest Indian Mission is taken away and renamed the Holbrook Mission, which is supposed to include white people and Indians, whoever happens to live in that area, like any other mission would. And so there's this pressure to, you see this shifting away from special programs for special groups. And even at BYU, they had all these Indian programs that were being absorbed into a larger multicultural program. Instead of having the Indian program, it's the multicultural. You know, there was the Indian magazine was Eagle Eye, and it was all about Indians. But by the 1980s, it's about Indians and Mexican Americans and African Americans, and anyone who's got a hyphenated name belongs in the Eagle Eye. Right. So there's dissolving of the special Indian focus into a larger multicultural whatever. And of course, the Indian department gets dissolved. There's a lot of talk about that. But so there's these pressures happening, and we don't really know all the details, but Packer oversaw it. And so he ends up getting a lot of negative response from Native Americans who felt like he targeted their programs. Did he? I don't have any evidence to say. Well, I just know that he presided and you know, he probably had a significant influence, but I don't have any evidence that speaks to exactly what he did.
And so maybe we should have
the program was declined.
Maybe you should have a program on George P. Lee specifically, but let's just say that there was a prominent general authority named George P. Lee, as we talked about at the beginning, that really was a poster child. Then we have him kind of spiraling out of control and eventually excommunicated. Talk briefly about that, and did he bump heads with Packer?
He grew frustrated. He was told not to talk about Indian affairs at conference, and he kept doing it anyway. He was told he's not a specific Indian apostle or Indian 70, Indian authority. He's just a general authority generally, but he kept talking about Indians and moving, going to Indian conferences and focusing on that. And then he said George Lee said that he was censured repeatedly and told he wasn't allowed to talk on this or that or not allowed to speak at all at different places. And then eventually, of course, Lee published his letters that were outright challenging the authority of the apostles and telling them that they had, you know, taken away the role of the Lamanites and that they were supposed to take over and that there was a bunch of power-hungry white men running the church. And that didn't go over well at all. So they brought him in and they took his temple recommend and excommunicated him and released a statement that he was excommunicated, but they would not discuss why.
Now, there are rumors that it was for child molestation. Have you heard that?
Sure. He was involved in child molestation case. He was found guilty, I think, of two cases. He was, the same time this is happening, he was involved in child molestation. Absolutely.
And so those are credible?
Inspired?
Do you think those are credible allegations?
I think he was convicted? There's definitely court cases over it. I think he was convicted, wasn't he?
Okay.
Maybe not.
Okay.
There was litigation. There was definitely litigation. So, yeah, he was definitely involved in child molestation. I just don't remember all the details of whether or not what happened there.
But then at some point, at some point, it seems like he went quiet. And I remember reading some report that there was kind of this deal where he could keep his pension as a general authority if he stopped talking about it. Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about that. There's a great set of interviews. He did like 23 hours worth of interviews that were lost until about a year ago when they magically showed up in Salt Lake in the archives with a restriction on them that I'm not allowed to access them.
Oh.
But there's a wonderful piece of research there. If anybody can ever get in and get to it, maybe down the road when the church is a little less sensitive about it, there's a lot there that could be done.
Wow. Who did the interviews? Do you know?
I can't remember. It was a church archivist, but I don't remember.
Okay, so the program gets dismantled. Is there anything else about the dismantling that's...
Yeah. One last thing is, so by 1992, the program is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and then there's a lawsuit. There's a foster care program that's run totally independent of the church that takes kids, troubled teens, out of the Navajo Reservation and puts them in southern Utah homes, and those kids... to help get them over their, you know, whatever problems they're facing. And that they were finding that they were getting one of the local schools wanted to charge them money to enroll their kids. And they said, well, your kids aren't citizens of the state, so they don't get free education. And the program said, well, we can't afford to pay for that. That should be free. And they said, well, you don't make the placement kids pay. And so it went to court. And the guy, the Sundance company, was trying to get equal treatment for his kids. And it turned out that was exactly the excuse that the church needed to say, well, fine, we'll just cut the program altogether. And so they cut the program.
Because there was some litigation.
Right, because of litigation, it was a convenient time to say, well, we'll just then you don't have to provide equal access to this private organization because it doesn't. We're not going to have it either. We're going to cancel the program. And so the placement program essentially terminated at that point.
And that was 92-ish.
Yeah, it was 92. They made a deal that you could like grandfather in a few more students, but they were all supposed to graduate out of high school by 1996. The fact is a few caseworkers still picked up a few more kids here and there, labeling them under the regular foster care program. So they kind of continued up until about 2000 when I think the last student that was Native American participating in this finished the program.
Okay. So, you know, I was born in 69 and Kimball is definitely the first prophet that I remember. And I remember having very tender feelings for him. You know, I remember when he got throat cancer. I remember these film strips or videos he would put out where he would speak to the membership. And I just remember having very tender feelings for him. But I also very much remember, and you can tell me if I just created this memory, him actually creating film strips about how important the church's role in developing the Native Americans was and how central this was to the overall mission of the church. And so am I remembering that right? Did he release such videos?
Yes, there was at least one I found in the Indian Committee meeting minutes that the BYU produced that was on his instruction that there was designed to promote the program.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he made others.
And so I'm contrasting that with the program just completely disappearing. And it, you know, I think about like, you know, whether it's the dynastic ceilings that happened in the 19th century Mormonism, whether it's polygamy, whether it's the fact that women used to be allowed to ordain with the laying on of hands and then they couldn't. Like, you know, there are certain or blacks, you know, receiving the priesthood after for 150 years being told that it was in many cases even doctrine that they weren't to have the priesthood. Like, I'm always amazed at how Mormonism has these significant seismic shifts in emphasis. And then you fast forward 5 or 10 years and it's like, huh, what was that? I don't even remember. What are you talking about?
Right.
Talk about that for a second. If that's something you've thought about.
Yeah, you know, you're totally right. It seems so strange that this program that was a major part, it was the heart of, I mean, it's huge. There's conference talks, there's programs all over, there's kids participating everywhere you look, there's an Indian kid, and then it's just gone. And how do you, I thought that was central to our mission, right? But that seems to be the Native American policy for the church generally. And also it's, you know, looking beyond Mormonism, it's part of the federal government's Native American policy as well, that there seems to be this strange shift back and forth between, you know, assimilate and encourage sovereignty and cultural authority. And so it kind of goes back and forth, and it does so in the church as well. One of the debates in the history is whether the church's Indian policy is just the same as the federal policy or whether there's something uniquely different about it. And I'm inclined to see that it's pretty similar, that we have the same shifts in our church or towards Indians as the federal government had, that there's this period of trying to assimilate them and then trying to like leave them on their own and trying to assimilate them. And I see those two pressures in the placement program, that there's those who wanted to assimilate and those who wanted to help. And for a while, they were on the same page there with the placement program. But eventually, they weren't. The placement program just didn't seem to meet the needs of people who wanted more rapid assimilation. They said, this isn't happening fast enough, or it's not happening at all, and we're going to just move on to some other program. And they used the guise of the correlation movement to do it, to say, well, we need to correlate programs, and they need to be under priesthood authority so we can go ahead and start removing things. But why does it happen? I don't know. It is strange, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really strange. Real quick, I'm going to follow up on this, but is George P. Lee still alive or is he not alive anymore?
He just passed away about a year ago, maybe less.
Do we know if he left his records with anybody or, you know?
I don't know anything about them except that those interviews, I knew that he had the interviews. I knew that when he did the interviews, he demanded that he have possession of them. And so that's why I was following closely where they went, and then they showed up at the church. So he must have somehow had a duplicate copy or something. I don't know. But I don't know where his other records are.
Do you know any family members to get a hold of to find out?
No, I haven't. No, I thought about pursuing something with him because I think he'd be fascinating to write a new biography of him, but But without those interviews, it just seems kind of silly. I'll wait until I can get the interviews before I invest the energy in chasing him down.
And you think that someday they will share them?
Oh, sure. Someday they'll open up. It takes time. You know, when he was first excommunicated, the church was really sensitive and really afraid. They sent representatives down to the Navajo reservation to hold town hall meetings and to ask people, hey, how important is it to you that George P. Lee was excommunicated? How much has that changed your testimony? Has that changed your attitudes? And they tried to convince people that it wasn't a big deal, but they generally found that most people thought it was annoying, thought it was frustrating, but it didn't change their testimony. But the church was really sensitive about it right when it happened, and it stayed sensitive, well, to this day. But I think that as the Indian program passes away, I think as Elder Packer passes away, I think as we move down the road and this isn't part of our program anymore and it becomes less sensitive, I think that they'll open those records up. But, you know, it could take time. There's lots of things in there that are restricted access that they talk to you and they say, well, what are you doing with it? And they kind of evaluate whether or not they want to let you see something. And so I think that there'll be time when it opens up, but it's not right now.
Okay. Not there yet. And do we, I think I asked this before, but do you know is it reasonable to believe that Lee was still on the church's pension until he died?
I don't know anything about that.
Okay. And was he the first general authority excommunicated since like Richard Lyman of, I think, the '30s? Are you possibly aware of any others?
I don't know of others. There could have been, but I don't know of any others. Yeah, it's pretty significant. It's pretty unusual.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And that happened right around the time Paul Dunn was kind of put on emeritus status.
I think it probably speaks to the fear that, you know, there's this pressure to get Indians on board and get them to do the program. And then, you know, those who are opposed to the program can use him as an excuse to say, look, that's not working. Even the best one is, you know, this is unusual that we have to excommunicate. And, you know, that Kimball maybe was pushing a little too fast, a little too quickly, and they just aren't ready. And maybe now is not the time.
Do you have a sense for how many Native Americans remain members of the church to this day? Is it declining? Is it flat? Is it increasing? Any idea?
I have no idea.
Okay. So real quick, you know, there was a group at BYU, a performance group, along with the Young Ambassadors called Lamanite Generation, right?
Yes.
And, you know, the Book of Mormon title page, as I understand it, used to say something about, you know, well, you could talk about it, but talk about how what's happened to the term Lamanite in modern Mormonism, what you know about it being expunged from our vernacular, and then anything you know about DNA or archaeological stuff that sort of is forcing us to redraw the lines in terms of who we consider to be Lamanites and not.
Yeah, well, of course, the Book of Mormon's introduction does make a comment about this is for the Lamanites, and the Lamanites has historically been these native people. And more recently, there's been changes, right? It's 10 years ago now or so that the church changed the passage in the introduction of the Book of Mormon that said that the Lamanites are the principal descendants of Native Americans, to say that they're among the descendants of the Native Americans. So there's kind of a backing away from this commitment that these are the Indians. Though most recently, was it a month ago now, the church produced its, 2 months ago, something like that, that press statement about DNA and how it's still possible that there's Native Americans, that the Lamanites, that the Lehi's descendants are indeed Lamanites, are indeed Native Americans. So, you know, they're not totally backing away from the possibility, but it's become a possibility instead of a
certainty.
A certainty.
A fact, right?
Certainly. So that's a little odd. And the attitude, the loss of that word in our vernacular, you know, it used to always be used in the 70s about, you know, these Indians, these Lamanites that are being redeemed, and this Lamanite woman who married this man, and they use it as a living, alive identity, whereas now it's only used to refer to dead people in the Book of Mormon, that those, the Lamanites who encamped here and the Lamanites who marched there, it's no longer used to refer to living people. Is that a conscious decision? I don't know. I'm sure on the part of some people it is, but I think it's just a consequence of the programs all dissolving and they're not the focus anymore. They're now down the road in 100 years, maybe they'll be the focus again and it'll come back. Seems to be what's gone on, right? It was the focus in the 1830s, and then it disappeared, and 1850s, 1830s and 50s, it was a focus, and it disappeared, and then it came back in the mid-20th century, and it disappeared, and maybe it'll come back again, I don't know. But it definitely changes. It's not set in stone. It's not a, you know, people like to have things be true for always and forever, but the reality is it seems like that word is evolves and includes more people. And
you know, it seems like the failed experiment that the church sort of might consider to be the Indian Placement Program, at least from their perspective, combined with the DNA evidence and the historicity problems with the Book of Mormon, I wonder whether the church is done with the Native American as it relates to any special mission going forward.
Well, two things. I'm not sure I'd call it failed, because some people thought it was failed, definitely. But
I meant in the church's eyes. I'm not saying I called it a failure.
No, yeah. But even there, you see in those reports that were coming out, there's mixed results, and the presiding leadership thought it was a failure. But if you talk to the caseworkers, they mostly thought it was a success.
Right.
So, you know, mixed failure. And then whether they're done with this thing altogether, I think they're done for a while. But, you know, unless you abolish the Book of Mormon, you know, there it is haunting you, and you can come back to it any time down the road if we get somebody who's really motivated. I think that the correlation movement, trying to standardize everything, that we have to have a pipeline of authority, of leadership, and everybody's on the same page. The correlation movement is very much an assimilation movement. It's to make everybody follow the same Utah culture and the same directives from Salt Lake and put us all on the same page. And there's good and bad about that. It standardizes the manuals and this and that, but it gets rid of that diversity that we were talking about at the very beginning. And I think that that's a shift in human culture, that we shift back and forth between assimilation and encouraging and promoting diversity. And right now we're assimilation mode, but in 20, 30, 40 years, I could see us going back the other direction. It just takes, you know, a few people in key positions, and, you know, the one thing that is sure is change, right?
So, right. Interesting. So I remember very distinctly on my mission, whenever I had a Guatemalan companion, they would pridefully call themselves Lamanites, as if like they had the royal blood of Israel coursing through their veins. People would get up and bear their testimony and say, I know I am a Lamanite and that we're chosen. You know, do you have any indication that like people have been discouraged now in Latin America from using that term? Or is it alive and well? They're just kind of isolated, you know, and I'm particularly just dying to know if anybody's ever gone back to them and said, look at all this DNA evidence that's coming out, and look at all these challenges with the Book of Mormon. You know, hey, members of the church in Mexico, or hey, members of the church in Peru or Chile, we've been sold a bill of goods. For generations, we've been taught that this is who we are, and the scientific evidence, you know, and has this ever caused any, you know, crisis of faith among Latin American or Polynesian saints? Are you aware of any of that?
No, I that's beyond my scope. I'm sure that for some folks it may have, but I don't know. You know, I know that they don't use the term very often. I don't hear very much. I have lots of friends that are Mexican American Mormons that don't use that term at all. There was, at the last Mormon History Association conference, there was a gentleman that was Mexican American that spoke about the term Lamanite, and they had a whole panel on it, and he spoke about how this word is not him and it's not my people, and we're Mexican American, or, you know, that it is definitely phasing out and people aren't claiming it as much. But is it a overt effort by the church? I don't think so. I think the church just stopped using it and stopped focusing on it, and so it's that combined with, you know, multicultural awareness and people wanting to be proud of their own ethnic background. I think it's sort of just dying out. The church definitely was aggressive in killing it off. I mean, you had the Indian programs at BYU that promoted Indianness that no longer do that. So they've lost the support, and so they're sort of turning back to other identities. Keeping in mind that their other identities are just as fabricated as this one, I think. If you look at identities, they're all fabricated. And whether you're Navajo or Indian or Lamanite, those are all made-up identities that were created in order to teach, you know, to interact with you in some way.
What about American? Is that fabricated too?
Sure. I mean, everything's just a construction, right? I mean, nowhere set that you're – you know, the Native Americans, you know, they're mostly living in villages when white folks show up, Europeans show up and start interacting with them. And for the need to make treaties, they clump them together by language groups and start calling them names. And some tribes existed as tribes, but quite a few didn't. You know, the Navajo were decentralized villages and independent households that become a tribe when they're thrust into Bosque Redondo and imprisoned in 1864-61. So, you know, some folks might say, well, I want to be, I'm Navajo, I'm not this or that. Well, Navajo's pretty much a modern construction too. Well, I'm Indian. Well, Indian, that's a term, you know, Columbus, of course, being lost and confused. So they're all constructs at some way or another. And it's not so important who created it, I don't think, as it is whether or not you really associate with it. And if you think yourself a Navajo or a Lamanite or whatever you want to be, you know, that's what matters more than whether or not it's legitimate and who created it to begin with, because I mean, by virtue of you adopting it, does it become authentic? You know, I don't know.
It's still a tiny bit Orwellian to me that something can be so prominent and pervasive in Mormon culture.
Yeah.
And then two decades later, it's a distant, faint memory. And in the meantime, it's something that everyone's kind of somehow not worried about anymore. That
no, you're totally right. Yeah.
How does that happen?
I don't know. It's just, I don't know. We live in the here and now. I don't know why it can be so easily forgotten, but it was. And that's what I'm trying to resolve is I'm trying to get this thing published. We'll see how we get it done here soon. But I'm trying to get people to be aware that there was this huge program and it meant so much to so many people. Now, some people definitely opposed it, but others, it was the light of their lives. It just guided their way and they are so appreciative of it. So what sense do you make out of this clearly assimilationist program that some people loved and some people hated?
So if you had to summarize, you know, let's just say this is the close of the podcast now and you're being asked to provide some final commentary, what would you say about the whole thing?
I think that the placement program was a complicated program that met some needs, and people signed up and were eager about it in the early years. Oftentimes, they got a lot more than they bargained for. They thought they were just getting a good schooling, and they ended up getting a whole assimilative experience. And some of them rejected that and were frustrated and angry, and they remain to this day angry. Others totally adopted it, and they loved it, and it's part of their identity, and they might even still call themselves Lamanites. And there's others who have mixed feelings, and that's probably the largest group, who feel like, well, you know, there were some benefits. I got this good education. I got this new foster family that I still care about and love, and I have good relationships with. And I had problems. I lost my culture. I lost my language. I lost my dance. I lost part of my identity, and you know, I'm torn on it. And just as, you know, that this is a complicated program that different people have different feelings about, but I think there's got to be room for all of those attitudes, that it's not simply an assimilationist program, nor is it simply an example of good people saving other, you know, people in need. It's not just an outreach program. There's definitely some other motives there. So, you know, it's complicated, but ultimately, people should be up to their own, to left to themselves to sort of figure out what sort of sense they want to make out of it, whether it was for good or for bad. I think that there's plenty of evidence for both.
Wow. And so you're just kind of like reflective on it and find it fascinating and want to affirm anyone's characterization. If it's firsthand and meaningful, you want to support that perspective.
Yeah, I'm not interested in judging it as good or bad. It's had good and bad in it, so I'm not interested in trying to decry, this is another assimilationist effort by white people, or, oh, this is the greatest thing ever, it saved these poor Indians. It's both. And people need to decide how it affects them if they participated in it. But clearly it was intended by well-meaning people, and it had some consequences that were both positive and negative. And we've moved away from that program now, but it was definitely a part of our culture and church and part of what we operated and how we interacted with Native peoples.
And does this relate to faith or belief or testimony at all? Is this something that stands with other sort of common concerns that people bring up as something that might challenge faith in the 21st century? Or do you see this as more faith neutral or faith irrelevant? It's just a bureaucratic thing that really doesn't speak to prophetic authority or inspiration, or, you know, the inspiration of the church or the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon. Do you see this as faith neutral or not?
Well, I approach it from that direction, that it's just a bureaucratic oddity that's interesting to discuss and historically address in my work. But as an individual who is Mormon and who has faith and has to deal with it in that way, I don't know what to make of this thing. It was this odd program that we ran. And should it challenge someone's faith that the policy changed? I don't think so. I think that policies can change, and that's normal, and that happens. And while we like to believe in the consistency and that things don't change and the doctrine doesn't change, the reality is, for anyone who's done any research, is clearly things change over time. So you can either, you know, accept that and have faith in that, or you can be concerned by it and have a crisis of faith and say, oh my gosh, this means that, and, you know, connect the dots to wherever you want to go with it. I think that ultimately it's a personal choice, just like what your identity is, and something you have to decide for yourselves.
Mm. But for you, it's not a smoking gun or a deal killer.
No, not at all. I can see lots of programs change in the history of the church, and you know, I tend to try to, well, you know, I'm raised in the McConkie sort of background, and so I tend to see, like, there's truth and there's doctrine, it's unchanging, and then how do I rationalize clearly changing policies? Well, there's policies and administrators who do their own thing, and, you know, does the truth change? I don't know.
but for you, it doesn't call into question
that our leaders
are inspired or anything like that.
To me, this is just a case of administrators bickering over policies and how's the best way to accomplish the end goal, which is convert everyone, right? This is just a different policy, and policies come and go, and I'm fine with that. It doesn't bother me.
What about the Book of Mormon prophecy?
Well, depends how you want to interpret it, I guess. Some folks, you know, felt like George P. Lee felt like that meant that Lamanites were going to take that leadership right now, and it's ready to happen, and that. But you could see it differently. You could see it as Lamanites are going to play a role, and they're still available to play that role. I'm not too worried about it. I try not to make a faith position out of this. I look at this more academically and not as a spiritual sort of, you know,
sure,
experience.
Sure. Well, Matthew Garrett, this has been for me a fascinating 2 or 3 hours. So I really hope you are successful with the book contract.
Thanks.
And I'm super grateful that you would take the time to share this history with us. I know there's so much more, but I think this gives us a good 2 to 3 hours to help us at least get a feel for what happened. So I guess just to close, I want to thank my listeners for listening. Matthew, if there are any links of PDFs or of, you know, histories or pictures or anything you want to share, I guess I'd invite you to send me an email with some of those attachments or links, and I can put them up on this post. Usually listeners like to go up and ask questions or make comments up on mormonstories.org. Is there a chance you might be able to go there occasionally and just kind of see what people are ready?
Yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great.
Okay.
Okay.
So I'll definitely do that. And then I guess I'll just thank you again for coming on, and also thank my listeners for listening and tuning in. I hope to start releasing a weekly episode of Mormon Stories again, but my biggest problem really is just knowing what to ask about. Sometimes I feel like we've really covered the truth claim stuff, and I don't want to keep beating a dead horse there. Sometimes there are new, interesting things that come out. Sometimes I really want to focus Mormon Stories more on personal people's experiences in their lived lives of how to deal with faith crises, how to deal with family, how to raise children in an age where progressivism seems to be really rearing its head, but also the church in some ways seems to be retrenching. I guess what I want to just end with today is just asking my listeners who are supporters of this podcast to please send me feedback on what types of interviews you'd like me to do next. Because if I can find cool things to interview about that aren't tired and boring and repetitive, I'd love to do it. So that's my call to the listeners. Matthew Garrett, thank you again for joining us on Mormon Stories.
Thank you.
come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy.